petition to ensure no votes ended up getting counted twice. For NPR News, I'm Mark Zedeklik in St. Paul.
The Iraqi parliament has approved a resolution that allows thousands of non-U.S. troops to stay in Iraq for another 6 months. A separate U.N. mandate expires at the end of the year. The vote took place after Iraq's parliament speaker resigned. In Singapore, at least 170 people were trapped on the world's tallest Ferris wheel after a fire broke out in the wheel's control room. A local television station reported rescue workers raced to get passengers back on the ground, but only five made it to safety yesterday. Passengers were trapped in the Singapore Flyer some 100 feet up in the sky for more than 6 hours. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
Hi, this is Donda Beard, and I'm asking you to consider becoming part of WILL's Vision Circle. These are the friends of WILL who make gifts of $1,000 or more each year. Your Vision Circle gift will have a real impact on our ability to bring you great programs all year long, and it will help WILL serve you and the community better. As an added incentive to make your tax-deductible gift before December 31st, we'll say thank you with a beautiful Larry Camphor Prairiescapes calendar. For more information about the WILL Vision Circle, call me at area code 217-333-9393 or make your gift online at willpledge.org. Thanks.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from CarX Auto Services, locally owned and operated, offering complete auto and tire repair services at their three Champaign locations at 901 East University, 906 West Bradley, and 2216 South Neal, open 6 days a week.
Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for this program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the program, we will look back to one of the first Supreme Court rulings having to do with religion and public education. This was 1948. The case began as a challenge to a program of religious instruction that was held in the public schools during school time, and it ended up putting one family here, one Champaign-Urbana family, at the center of a national controversy. Our guest for the program this morning is Dan McCollum, someone who is well-known to folks here in Champaign-Urbana for having been involved in politics for a long time. He served as mayor of Champaign, also known as someone who has written a lot about and thought about the history of Champaign County. And he's authored a book now about what is not only an important national story, but is the story of his own family and their experiences with this precedent-setting case. The title of his book is The Lord Was Not on Trial, The Inside Story of the Supreme Court's Precedent-Setting McCollum Ruling. It's recently been published by Americans for Religious Liberty. So you can find it, I'm sure, in the bookstore. And as we talk, questions are welcome as well. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So if you want to join in the conversation, you're certainly welcome to do that. Thanks for being here.
Well, my pleasure.
This was in 1948. How old were you when all this was going on?
When the case was filed, I was 8, and it was in the court for 2.5 years.
Yeah. And this was the principal in this case was your older brother, Jim. It is Jim, right?
Yeah.
I have spent some time thinking about this and had a chance to talk with him and your mom about this a couple of years ago. So I want to make sure that I at least remembered that right. So he was the guy that was the center of the case. And how old was he?
He was 2.5 years older than I was. So that would make him 10, 11.
Mm-hmm. And the central matter of this had to do with, at the time, in the public schools in Champaign, there was religion class. It was taught by someone who was not the regular classroom teacher. Someone came from outside. And it was an opportunity for the kids. I guess they had their choice of three choices. And it was not required, but it was something that everybody just did.
Well, I guess to be more specific, it was put in 1940. And there had been a kind of an agreement between the Protestant churches who had assumed that one class would feed all, would fit all, the Catholic interest and Jewish. What happened, in effect, was that the Jewish group was not all that happy about it, but had been persuaded by a group of Protestant businessmen to go along, and I guess they were almost – this is the words of Reverend A. Ray Cartledge, who was probably the major domo of putting this program together. Damned if they did, damned if they didn't. They weren't comfortable with it and did not participate after about the second or third year. So it was really Protestant classes and which were held in various grades, and a Catholic class which, since most of the students were Protestant at the time, see, there was a Catholic school in Champaign, so many of the Catholic youngsters went to the Holy Cross. So the program operated, the religious teacher would come in, the secular teacher would leave, and those not taking the class would leave, and they would have the Protestant class in every grade level. And then once a week there would be a Catholic class, which all Catholics in the grades that were included, 4 through 6 at the time, would have one class. So it really disrupted the school program twice. It also, since they had to do a census to find out where you should go and so forth, involved actually identifying children by their religion. And this was particularly a problem with Jewish students because after they dropped the program, they weren't participating and, of course, wouldn't have participated in the Protestant class anyway. So they would have left just as I left, just as my brother left, and you were identified. It had some rather unpleasant repercussions for Jewish students.
When at first, it is my understanding is at first your brother was fine with being in the class, and I don't know if that was just that he was interested in exercising his curiosity, or maybe it was just because, well, everybody was doing it, and he figured, well, he would be in there with everybody else.
At that age, you don't like to stand out, and you'd like to be part of the crowd, and I think he would have been just perfectly happy to have gone to the class, but my father was very definitely opposed to any participation in the class. My mother was, I think, at the beginning sort of indifferent, but had to manage the situation. When my father said no, she had to deal with it. And so my brother did not take the class. And what happened rather quickly was that after being sent out of the class each week for this period of time, he became identified, and it was rather unpleasant for him.
Yeah, and it seems that maybe the thing that most concerned your mother. I'm sure that there was maybe some interest in the principle of the thing here, but I think that she was. It sounds as if she was really angry and upset about the sort of harassment that was visited on your brother because. He was the guy who was, when it came time for everybody to have this class, he was the guy who was sent out to sit in the hall.
Well, she had to deal with the situation. And when it had unpleasant consequences for my brother, she then became involved. She also was fairly well educated and had most of her undergraduate training at Cornell and had spent a year in law school here. So she was... I think well acquainted with what the law should be or what the law she felt was. And I think she said many times in my hearing and many others that she knew she was right. She knew that this was a violation of the First Amendment, or at least the way the First Amendment should be interpreted.
So if you ask this question of the two things, what was more of greater concern or what, to her, the constitutional principle or the kind of harassment that your brother faced and that eventually in the entire family experienced that, of those two things, which do you think that she would have said was more important?
Well, I think dealing with the family situation was what kicked her off. But once she got involved and began to really look into the situation, the more convinced she was that it was an unconstitutional activity.
Yeah. You really have to admire her courage and also wonder what about her made her the kind of person that she was that would give her the gumption to, in a sense, take on the schools and further really take on the entire community.
I think the interesting thing about it is when you start in something like this, you can never anticipate just how rough it may get. And it got rougher and rougher. But picture yourself crossing a rather raging torrent, and you get halfway out and you think, well, you know, this is not such a good idea. You can do one of two things, or maybe three, actually. Swept downstream, I guess, would be one of them. But you could either fight your way out across or back up to the shore you started from. My fix on it in my political experience has been that if you think you're right, you might as well just plain fight your way on across the raging torrent, because if you creep back or crawl back to the shore you started from, you've got every bit of the discredit and none of the respect for the courage of fighting your way through. And I think she got out in the middle of the stream and just decided, you know, I'm going to see this thing through.
Yeah. When I talked to her, I think that I asked her whether if she had it to do over again, she would. And as I recall, she said, well, she wasn't exactly sure. And I don't know how important that is a question at that point anyway. Do you think that she had regrets, or in fact, if she could have gone back, do you think she would have done the same thing?
I don't think so. I think that once she was involved, and then there were people and in this case from Chicago who had agreed to back her, that she had people that had made some reliance on it. As a matter of fact, the Chicago group that backed her, the Chicago Action Council, had protested this practice elsewhere, or at least were opposed to it elsewhere, and were looking possibly for a plaintiff. But this is a case where the plaintiff, in a sense, found them. Mm-hmm. And they were willing to support her because they felt that this was not a person likely to back out.
And, I certainly also wouldn't want people to get the impression that there weren't any people in Champaign-Urbana that were supporting her, because certainly there were. It might have been a minority, but certainly there were people who did support her and support the family.
There were very few people who were public. And I think the only really serious public person who backed her was the Unitarian minister, Philip Shug, who I think here was a man who was about 5'5", 5'6", a diminutive character, very intellectual, and just was a person of quiet, steady, but just unbelievable courage. He simply wasn't going to back up. And, of course, he was new in town. He was a first-time minister here at the local Unitarian Church. He had a lot to lose. This guy was really one of the unsung heroes of the affair.
Yeah. And that's sort of hard to almost put yourself in the mindset of the time that where people, for example, I'm sure that there were people within the university community that privately they would have said to your mother, to your dad, they would have said, well, we're with you on this, but we cannot do that publicly because we could lose our jobs, we could become ostracized. People were really afraid of what would happen if they would have come out and said, you know, I think that the McCollums are on the right side of this.
Picture Champaign-Urbana in 1945. We'd just been through the war. In fact, the case was filed after VE Day, but before VJ Day. And so the war was still going on. Mm-hmm. It was a time when public dissent on any kind of a scale was considered probably unpatriotic. And of course, because in the course of this, we were accused of being communists. A woman whose husband had a high echelon job in one of the prestigious departments of the university said, of course, Vashti, we support you, but it might compromise my husband's job. Mm-hmm. So they were quiet. So there really wasn't a lot of out-and-out public support other than Philip Shug.
We have a couple of callers here. I want to bring him into the conversation. Our guest is Dan McCollum. He is the author of a book that is the story of the McCollum case that involved his family. It was one of the first cases that had to do with religion in the public schools. This was, as he explained, this took some time for it to work its way through the courts, but eventually at the point where it came to the Supreme Court, we're talking about, and this was 1948, right, when the decision was announced. If you're interested in reading in some detail what this was like, what was at stake here, and what it meant for his family, you can look for his newly published book, The Lord Was Not on Trial, The Inside Story of the Supreme Court's Precedent-Setting McCollum Ruling. It's published by Americans for Religious Liberty. We have a couple of callers here. I want to bring them into the conversation. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's someone in Mahomet to talk with, line number one. Hello.
Yes, I was on the other side of the question. In my school, it was voluntary. It was after school. It was not part of the school day. Nobody left the room. We met with May Chapin and her sister in the basement of the school after school. It was not a part of the school day, and it was a very sad event for me, because I did not go to Sunday school or church, and so this was the only connection I had with religion. And suddenly, we weren't allowed to meet after school voluntarily. Only those people that chose to come came. And I think that this is portrayed as a wonderful, courageous event for your mother. And it was not a wonderful, courageous event for me. And I don't think that you considered the other side of the question at all when you did it. I mean, the idea in this country, if one person objects to anything, we take it out of the system without considering the other 95 or 96% of the people who might want it. So it was a very sad event for me, and I'm so tired of you lauding your mother and the whole process with the idea that it was great, because to me it wasn't great, it wasn't wonderful, and it wasn't the right thing to do. Thank you so much, and goodbye.
I think that, first of all, in contrast to the caller's comments, when the case was instituted, it did break into the school day. It was held during school hours on school property. So I hope that she understands that different. I don't know how what school she was in, but I was in the school at the time, and I know that the class was broken up for the religious class. It was held absolutely on school time. But I think more deeply here is an understanding of the Bill of Rights. It is the whole idea of freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of religion, is that you have that freedom in spite of what 95% of the people think or do or want. That if you have one person in a crowd of 100 who is speaking and is threatened by the crowd of 100, the point is that the one person who is out of sync with the rest has an absolute right to their opinion. And the same thing is true of religious liberty. If you have a minority religious group, you tolerate them because they have a right. It's an absolute guaranteed right by the First Amendment. It says that Congress shall establish no law respecting an establishment of religion. That has been interpreted by the Supreme Court on numerous occasions as including to the states the 14th Amendment, which says no person shall be deprived without due process of law of these rights. And so the Supreme Court, I think, has stuck by what I think the original framers of the Constitution had in mind, That is that people have a right to be different. And when you have a situation such as occurred in the Champaign schools, it was a disability to be different. And that was wrong.
You know, I guess one of the things that really strikes me about this, you know, having talked with you and your mom about this, is that these events took place in the late 40s. And it's been more than 50 years since this all happened. There are still people who are angry about this and are still angry with you and with the McCollums generally. Now, half a century after this happened.
Well, I think the caller is representative of that. It has never been a political asset to me. And I think my father, who is now long deceased, would have been amazed that I subsequently achieved enough credit or credibility to be elected mayor of this of Champaign mm-hmm. three times. Mm-hmm. So, but it did play a factor in running for state senate because I won Champaign-Urbana. I won Champaign County, but I lost the Vermilion County. And it was the lawsuit was raised over there, and I lost that county.
Let's talk with someone else here. This is a caller in Champaign, line two. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Yes.
Fascinating subject. I'm a historian as well as a Roman Catholic, and I have some strong feelings about the whole thing. And I think as a historian, I go back, and I think it's very, you can argue both sides of this point, that the religion and state, there are many people who wanted to secularize the schools and things, but if you look back at the history and the tradition, that there in the public schools, there was the Bible, there was teaching for a long, long time before this decision came up, and during all that time, there were quietly and vocally people who opposed it. And I was curious, the first question for Dan was the decision by the Supreme Court unanimous or not?
It was 8-1.
Okay. So even then, you know, there's one guy saying, hey, you know, there is a, and those guys aren't dumb, there's an argument to be made that you can have this. But here's the real, I think, you know, we can live in the past or we can live in the future. I'm a sixth grade CCD teacher, and the kids, and I have my kids who have been blessed to go to Catholic schools, and there's a ton of issues with public schools, private schools, vouchers, and all that we won't get into, but the point is that I think that there should be today options for people into school, just like at the University of Illinois. I took a class on communion. It's a public university, yet they teach a class about communion in conjunction with the Newman Center, but it's a U of I class. You get credit like any else. In the high school, in the middle school, in the grade schools, there needs to be an option for these kids and these families who say, we want our kid educated because a Catholic, a Protestant, is a very dangerous person who only knows so little about their faith. And I wonder what your thoughts are on today, not in the past, whether you see any, from your perspective, any place in the school where a kid could seek religious education. And I appreciate your service to the city, and I know that you're feelings about this are genuine, and I respect them. Would like to get your thoughts on that.
The case that was cited in behalf of my mother at the trial level was the Ring case that was, I think, 1910, where there was a Bible reading in the public schools, in a public school in Illinois, that used the King James Version of the Bible. The case was raised by the parents of a Catholic student. And I think you can see where I'm going here.
Yeah.
This is something that probably, and I think this is what my family believed, was best left to the family and the church. This is not something that ought to be brought into the public schools where theoretically, there is the great melting pot where we should all learn to be living together, tolerant of each other, not separated out by religion. The classes in Champaign separated people out by religion and identified them by religion. In fact, they even conducted a census every year to see who should go where as far as the classes in which they participated.
And I understand in that time that was difficult. I think in today's time people could do that. And you might have some Muslims who want to go to the Christianity class and learn about it. Not so much as this is only religious education for the faithful, but also people who say, you know, I want to get to know my brother better and find out, you know, what his religion is about. So
we had no objection to a survey course in religion. In other words, if you wanted to the public schools wanted to offer a survey course on all the religions or the major religions, there was no objection here. It's when it got down to sectarian religious indoctrination, we felt it should not be in the public schools.
I understand that. I just wish today that there were opportunities, and I think the pendulum has swung so far the other way now that it's very difficult to get momentum for that, and especially when they have so many other agendas. For me, as a faithful Catholic, I think that's the number one thing we should be teaching our kids versus that's a leftover. But that's just my opinion.
Well, I think the problem is that what the churches and the families are just not doing their job.
We are at a midpoint here. I appreciate the comments of the caller. We have some others we'll get to in just a moment. Again, our guest this morning is Dan McCollum, somebody who should be well-known to folks in Champaign-Urbana for having been involved in local politics for a long time. He served 3 terms as the mayor of the city of Champaign, continues to be very interested in the history of Champaign County. And we're talking here about an important event in the history of Champaign-Urbana that was also an important event in the history of his family, and that was the McCollum case. It was one of the early cases that had to do with religion and public education, went to the Supreme Court. The ruling came in 1948, and he's written a book about this. His book is titled The Lord Was Not on Trial, The Inside Story of the Supreme Court's Precedent-Setting McCollum Ruling. And the number here is 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Was there some further point you wanted to make sort of in response to what the caller was talking about?
No, I think that clearly when you reach the public, when you're in the governmental aspect of either all the way from education up through the business of government itself, that it should be secular, that everyone ought to feel free and comfortable at the table. And anything that separates out people by race, ethnicity, religion, that segregates them out or draws attention to their differences is not appropriate at that stage. So I think I think the founders understood this. They understood the problems with religious differences in Europe. The multiple religious wars that went on, and they figured when they enacted the Bill of Rights that this was something that should be avoided here.
At the time, certainly your mom was attacked. People said that she was an atheist. People said that she was against religion. What were her personal views about faith and matters of faith and religion?
Well, we were not church attendees until the Law case, and then we joined the Unitarian Church, mainly because her chief local supporter was Philip Shug, who was the minister. Mm-hmm. But I think my mother was largely indifferent to it. It just was not a part of her life. She had her thing she did, and she just simply probably a-religious rather than having a definite viewpoint on one side or the other. My father was raised in the Deep South, where it was a very, evangelical in the extreme form of religion, and he grew up. That was what was his family were Baptists and Presbyterians, and he just simply developed a strong aversion to that, and simply was not going to have any religious indoctrination for his children, and that was that.
Yeah. Just, I want to get to some other callers here in a second, but we were talking just a little bit before we got going about your grandfather, about your mother's father, mm-hmm. and his being an interesting character and certainly someone who must have had a great impact on the formation of your mom's character. He also, I think, during the trial was maybe one of the more flamboyant kind of people to take the stand. He certainly had very strong feelings about this.
Well, my mother was baptized a Lutheran. Her mother was German Lutheran. It was not until after my mother and her sister had left for college and were on their own that my grandfather really became the describe would be a village atheist of some regional renown. But I don't think that the family impact was not present while she was growing up, or at least that aspect of it. She attended various Sunday schools at one time or another. And, I think that probably it was a sort of a religious neutral attitude. My mother did tell one story I thought was interesting. She came home from a Sunday school one time, and apparently there had been a lot of talk about hell and damnation, and she went to her mother, who was a Lutheran as well. I mean, that's where why she was baptized Lutheran. And my grandmother said to her, well, when she expressed her concern about it, she said, oh, you don't have to worry about that.
That's for other people to worry about. You don't have to worry about that. Well, let us talk with some other folks here. Go to next caller in Champaign in line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. Peace to you, Mr. McCullough. I have not always agreed with you politically, although I do generally, and I'm very glad to speak with you in this peaceful fashion. And it is very difficult for me to speak peacefully upon this when I hear some of the their viewpoints. First of all, I'd like to point out that schools are already kind of a catch-all for our society, and they're already doing things which are pretty amazing outside of the school day curriculum. And so when we look at times where perhaps things like physical education and music and arts, which are considered to be a traditional core curriculum, are very hard to fit into current budgets and even curriculums where you have a reading and a language arts class. I can agree to, yes, at a high school level, a survey course, but I find other people's comments about having religious instruction in schools kind of strange. The other thing I'd like to say is it does take incredible courage. Even today, there's a large amount of intolerance in most settings, unfortunately, and in schools, even where people are very polite, sometimes there's some very strong and strange notions about other religions and other beliefs. So I commend, it sounds like quite a story, you know, sounds like, in fact, your father, was he a religious person?
No, he was not, but he was a very quiet self-effacing person. He just didn't deal with the issue other than that he didn't want his children indoctrinated in any sectarian faith.
Oh, okay, cool. Because I know that a lot of people forget that, at least when you and I were young, that religion was a very personal thing. And in fact, it was almost just one of those topics you didn't really want to talk about because it was so touchy. And I think people need to remember that it is very uncomfortable if you are the person who is outside the norm, and especially if you can be marked, as apparently your brother was, it sounds like, that is, whether it makes people happy or not, that is the legal basis of the court's ruling. So if you could talk, I love the Supreme Court, if you could talk a little bit about how the case actually progressed, and I'd be curious to know, like, did your brother and mother get called up, or was it just lawyers? And I'll sit back and listen. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Well, overall, I can say that the saving grace for my brothers and me was the fact that I had a very strong, caring family, and we were, in many respects, kind of isolated during those years. There wasn't a lot of I was even told by the parent of my closest friend that I shouldn't play with his son, my age. It was kind of a bit of a shock. We played together anyway, but the time, it was an uncomfortable time, and the saving grace was a very warm family. I would say that had that not been the case, I would have turned out almost certainly much differently.
Do you want to, the caller was just interested in talking about how the case worked its way along, and it did work its way through the various levels. It didn't go immediately right to the Supreme Court because you lost it. It was tried at every level up to that at the
Circuit Court. It was tried before a 3-judge panel, which was a little unusual. They did not rule at the end of the trial, but waited, wanted briefs. I think it was a foregone conclusion. My mother never expected to win at the local court. Incidentally, the chief judge, Judge Leonard, was in fact a former school board attorney, and the attorney for the school board was Mr. Leonard's partner, John Franklin. So probably today that would have been challenged as a conflict, and Judge Leonard would have been excused, I think. But the case was appealed to the state Supreme Court. It lost there unanimously. But between that decision and the appeal to the Supreme Court, the New Jersey bus case was decided, in which the Supreme Court language was very, very definite about just what the Establishment of Religion Clause meant. And the ruling was of such a nature that I think most serious scholars at the time felt that the wind had changed, mm-hmm. and that the Supreme Court was going to have a much more favorable view of my mother's case.
And if this there would have been some case if this had not been the McCollum case, it would have been somebody somewhere would have challenged the kind of religious instruction that was going on in public school.
Well, there was no question because subsequent cases such as the Shemp case, which was Bible reading, or the Murray case, which was prayer. It was building up. But my mother's case was the first case where they actually held that the practice violated the First and 14th Amendments.
Yeah. That in one case, the issue was the separation of church and state, and the other was the fact that they're saying that the First Amendment applies to state government. So those two things can...
Well, they felt that they had to find out just exactly what the 14th Amendment meant with the due process clause, and they felt that it meant at least the guarantees of the First Amendment.
We have some other callers. Let's go next to someone else in Champaign, line 3. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. McCollum, very much for the fight. It has been my opinion these many years. I'm 55 years of age, and every grade school, junior high school, and high school I ever attended in the Champaign-Urbana area had a church either within eyesight or at least you could hear the bell from the front door of the school of one or another church somewhere nearby. And as such, it's always been my opinion that anyone who was sincerely interested in learning about religion in general or other people's religions in particular could very, very easily do so anytime they wanted to. If they wanted to pray during the course of the day, there were churches all over the place they could walk into and pray their little hearts away all they wanted to.
Well, they could pray in school if they wanted to quietly. I mean, there was no law against praying. It was just where it was a publicly orchestrated or a school orchestrated affair.
Well, as such, and as an example, the first lady who called, who I would like to have asked her what force of nature was keeping her out of churches and Sunday schools. Why is it that this activity, after school activity, so she claimed, was her only contact with the religious community? The upshot of or the gist of everything I'm trying to say here is that, and especially in this day and age with internet access and libraries and so forth, anybody who wants to learn about religion can do so with such ease. It's just astonishing. And therefore, all these attempts to keep prayer in school and intelligent design and other, you know, religious indoctrination, trying to sneak that into the classroom is really just indoctrination and insidiously so. It's just not necessary. And anyone who is sincerely of interest in one thing in this sort of thing or another has multiple outlets, multiple ways to learn, multiple ways to acquire, multiple ways to participate that have absolutely nothing to do and don't require our school systems to do that for them. Now, thank you very much.
I'd like to just offer another comment here. The title of the book is "The Lord Was Not on Trial," and that was that came up at the first day of the trial when a young man came up to the superintendent of schools, Eugene Mellon, a tall, courtly man, who announced he'd come to testify for the Lord. Frank Mellon said, "You'll need to talk to our attorney, Mr. Franklin, over there." Franklin was a tall, kind of Lincoln-esque type-looking guy, and he walked over to Franklin and announced that he'd come to testify for the Lord. And Franklin and I can just see him. And John Franklin and I got to be good friends the latter part of his life. He said, "The Lord, sir, is not on trial here today." And it was probably summed it up pretty well. The fact was that it was the practice. Unfortunately, my mother's attorney pictured himself as a latter-day Clarence Darrow and tried to make a real show out of this thing, much to my mother's concern and angst, actually. But the fact was that it was really over the intrusion of the instruction in the schools, not a war against religion, as many people interpreted it.
Yeah. And I seem to recall as your mom worked her way up the ladder between talking to the school superintendent and talking to the school board and then talking to Mr. Franklin, that I remember when I talked to her and read the book that she had written, one of the things I noted down was that he warned her. He said to her, you know, if you do this, the McCollums are going to be pretty unpopular around this community. He was trying to say, you know, are you sure that you really want to do this? Because he realized that what would happen, and that is indeed what had happened.
That's true.
Let us go next to another caller, and this would be, I believe, Effingham and line number 4. Hello.
Yes, thank you. Three things. The first thing I'm thinking of is the God in the Pledge, I think, came along in the 1950s.
1954.
Yes, and that, you know, is egregious as well. The second thing is part of my experience of late. I was never confronted or accosted, either in Charleston, where I used to live and go to city council meetings, and when I moved here to Effingham, I did some of the same thing. But it occurred to me that I did not have to stand to repeat the Pledge of Allegiance, and I didn't, and I sat, and I was never confronted there. I think it was on the cusp of it here in Effingham, but I have not gone lately, so I don't know. So I took time to look up. I think it was in the 30s or early 40s when the pledge was compulsory and then was made compulsory, and then I think after the war, it was not that the I think the Mormons brought the case, which is kind of ironic.
I think it was the Seventh-day Adventists.
The Adventists then, yes. Okay, I knew it was one of those groups. But nevertheless, the compulsory nature of those things, which I've researched and did found out what I could about it, but the thing that keeps ringing in my mind is that Congress shall make no law. And congressional law, if I understand it, or constitutional law, preempts congressional law. Would that be right?
That's correct.
Yes, well, then...
That's why we have an amendment process.
Yes, and that, isn't it wonderful? I think the Constitution, I mean, I'm far to the left, but the Constitution, as we know it, which is under siege now, the fact that it remains... gives me some glimmer of the future, where the what is wrong with this social organization will be righted by that constitution. I thank you, sir, for this program. I very enlightening, and the verve and the nerve. I tell you, it when I hear or think about that, it is very refreshing. And thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Our guest here this morning is Dan McCollum. We'll be here for about another 5 minutes in this part of Focus 580. If you'd like to read the story of the McCollum Supreme Court case of 1948 that involved his family, you can look for his book, The Lord Was Not on Trial. It's published by Americans for Religious Liberty. And we have a couple of other people here, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Next, someone in Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Hi. I think a very important thing that's being left out is, if I got the story correctly, Dan's brother was actually beaten up. Because he wasn't just singled out and identified, but because he was identified, he was harmed. And if I get it right, they actually had to send him to live with a family member to protect him. So, I mean, that's the human element. That's the child element. It's not just high-minded, legal, and so forth. It was real, if I have that correct, and I'll hang up and listen.
It wasn't just my brother. Jewish students who had been identified because of the fact that they didn't take the classes were beaten up after school, and one of the account of one of those incidents was related is related in the book.
Well, tell a little bit of the story of tell us about Halloween of 1945.
Well, I remember it quite well. It was after the trial, and the doorbell rang. My mother went to the door to pass out the candy, and she was greeted with a barrage of everything that was left over in the garden, and of course, she was quite shaken up about the whole incident, and of course called the police. But culprits had long since disappeared. I think that was the only real assault on the house, which was again quite unpleasant and actually downright frightening. But I think the worst part of it was just simply the isolation, punishment at school from our peers.
Yeah. And it did. It was the case, as the caller said, that there, for a time Jim went and did he go and live with your grandparents?
He was. It got really bad for Jim, and he was sent to Rochester to live with my maternal grandparents.
Hmm. One. We'll try and do at least one more caller here. This would be Belgium, over in Vermilion County, line number 3. Hello.
Yes, I'd like to ask a question of your guest that's totally off of this subject. If I remember right, didn't you write a book about the Vermilion watershed?
I did.
And, my Bible.
It's out of date, and I'm trying to revise it.
Oh, good. That's a question I was going to ask. Use it regularly. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We have a couple minutes left here. Your mother, Vashti, wrote a memoir about her experiences. So if people would like to read a first personal account from her, they can read that book. Why did you feel that you really wanted to do your own account of this?
Well, her book is a memoir written from her point of view with the information she had at her disposal. I inherited my grandfather's files, and he had extensive files and letters that he had received and written on this case with all sorts of personalities. And then her scrapbooks, which had just an unbelievable number of newspaper magazine articles, which I have now donated to the University of Illinois Library, but 5 scrapbooks just full of stuff. So I had access to materials that far exceeded what she had, and my goal was to write an account of the case. I wasn't taking sides. I was just writing a story of just what happened. So I guess to in a way respond to the first caller, my intention was to simply tell what happened.
It seems remarkable to me that on the one hand, as we talked earlier, that there are still people who live in Champaign-Urbana who remember this, who have strong feelings about it one way or another. And then there are people who have never heard of the McCollum case, something that at the time, this was a big story from coast to coast. This was national headlines. Your mom was in the papers everywhere across the United States. What would you like people, for those people who say, I never heard of this before, what is it that you would like them to know particularly?
I think the most important thing is the importance of really what the Bill of Rights means. The idea that the country, at least in terms of on the public level, really needs to have a sense of neutrality that doesn't mean it has to be indifferent to religion, but at least in no way does it promote one over another or in particular support any particular religion. The idea is that this is something that is private. It's should be left to the family, to the church, and that in the public sector, this should be a totally neutral atmosphere where everyone, all citizens, ought to feel comfortable.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that after this was all over and the case was decided in your favor, that there were people apparently who would have liked to see your mother go on to be a leader in the area of civil liberties. And after it was over, she sort of said, no, I did this. I'm done with that. It seemed that she just wanted to go back to living life as normally as possible.
She enjoyed several years of being a minor celebrity and was president of the American Humanist Association for 3 years back in the very early 50s. But then she went on with the rest of her life. She was not Madeline Murray. She was her own person who just simply did this, been there, done that, and moved on.
Yeah. She passed away in August of 2006?
Correct.
Is that right? Was it something that she liked to talk about or was interested in talking about? Or were there ways in which do you think that she felt that, well, that was, yes, I lived through all of that, but that was sort of the past, and to her what she had done more recently was more interesting.
Oh, she traveled to 160 countries, had slideshows, and that was far more of an important part of her life than the law case. But it came up every 10 years on the anniversary of the decision, and so it made the news, and she responded, but then it was dropped for another decade.
Yeah. Your youngest brother probably was too young really to remember much about this, but certainly you and your older brother, this is a big part of your growing up. How do you think that this affected the kind of person that you are?
It's character building if you survive it.
Our guest this morning is Dan McCollum. If you'd like to read more about the story of the McCollum case and what that all meant for his family, you can look for the book that he's written on this, The Lord Was Not on Trial, The Inside Story of the Supreme Court's Precedent-Setting McCollum Ruling, and it is published by the Americans for Religious Liberty. Is your mom's memoir, is that still in print?
It's still available. And I should be in the local libraries. So, it's still around.
And remind me, the title of the book is it One Woman's Story?
One Woman's Fight.
One Woman's Fight. All right, by Vashti McCollum. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David.
Support for the program, Focus 580, comes from the Infant Parent Institute, celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. Programs here on WILL also made possible by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, welcoming 2009 with three opportunities in January to enjoy the Russian National Ballet Theater, performing the timeless story Sleeping Beauty. More information is at KrannertCenter.com. Well, that's it for us. Up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine. Hosting the program today is Tom Rogers.
Good morning, David. And then coming up in the Afternoon Magazine, in the 1 o'clock hour, an archive interview with Celeste Quinn and the author of the book Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, An American Controversy. We'll look at the life of Sally Hemings, a slave, the mistress of Thomas Jefferson. That's coming up in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine. Right now, let's take a look at the commodity markets. The wheat is Trading lower today, setting back from Monday's late bounce. Corn is up, underpinned by concerns about dryness in Argentina. The beans are also up, opening on disappointing crush data, then firmed with a thin holiday trade all around. Right now, March wheat is at 5.86 a bushel, down 3.25 cents in Kansas City. The May at 5.91 and a half, down 8 3/4. Chicago March wheat is at 5.64 a bushel, down 5. July 5.84 and a half, down 9. In the corn pit, March is at 3.90 a bushel, up 8 1/4 cents. The May up 9 at 4.01. July 4.11, up 8 1/2. January soybeans are at 8.93, up 6 1/2 a bushel. The March at 8.96 and a quarter, up 5 3/4. May beans at 9.0.